Welcome. In the previous lecture, we examined how the Greek city prospered under Roman rule. In this lecture, we're going to turn the spotlight on individuals, specifically focusing on Greeks who either visited or resided in Rome, and on Romans who either visited or resided in Greece. We've already touched on this topic in an earlier lecture entitled Philhellenism and Hellenophobia, but that was about opinions and stereotypes. In this lecture, we're going to consider to what extent and for what reasons, or alternatively under what compulsion, Greeks and Romans upped and left their native land, whether on a temporary or a permanent basis. A general point to note at the beginning: there are very few first-hand reports from Greeks in Rome or from Romans in Greece, so we can't talk much about the experiences of individuals. First, I'm going to talk about Greeks living in Rome. As we saw at the very beginning of our course, a Greek-speaking people, the Mycenaeans, were living in Italy long before Rome had been founded, as early as 1600 BC. There were also Greek colonies in Italy from the middle of the 8th century BC. What we don't know for certain, however, is whether any Greeks made it to Rome in the 8th, 7th, 6th, 5th, or even 4th centuries BC. There's just no evidence to go on. What we do know is that they had begun to trickle in by the first half of the 3rd century BC at the latest. One of the earliest on record is Lucius Livius Andronicus, who came from Tarentum and who was perhaps captured when the city fell to the Romans in 272 BC. If so, he would have been a child at the time. Livius eventually became a teacher for the children of a Roman consul called Livius Salinator, whose name he later took upon earning his freedom, as was common practice for manumitted slaves. Livius is a fascinating phenomenon. He demonstrates that Greeks were able to make their mark and wield considerable influence in Rome at this date, even if they started off as slaves. Not only is he quite possibly the first Greek to become a teacher in Rome, but he's also quite definitely the first person to have a play performed in Rome, both a tragedy and a comedy, in 240 BC. By the beginning of the 3rd century BC, freeborn Greeks were also trickling into Rome. You'll recall that when Titus Quinctius Flamininus made his proclamation of freedom in 196, the Greeks awarded him divine honours. Other grateful Greeks, as his biographer Plutarch reveals, erected a bronze statue of him in Rome. And we know this, that they were Greek, because the inscription it carried was written in Greek, which means that there were Greeks living in Rome not only with enough cash to pay for a bronze statue, but also enough clout to have it erected in the capital. They were likely clients of Flamininus, that's to say, individuals who were dependent upon him for their welfare. I talked a bit about the client-patron relationship earlier. A client could be a person of any social rank who allied himself to a superior. No doubt Flamininus's Greeks were drawn from the elite, and doubtless other Roman generals who served in Greece attracted similar followings, clients, that is, whom they brought back with them to the capital after their service had ended. The most celebrated client-patron relationship involving a Greek and a Roman was that of the younger Scipio and the historian Polybius. In his history, he actually states that Scipio, I quote, became inseparable from me and preferred my company to that of anyone else. Polybius, you'll recall, was one of the 1,000 Achaean hostages who were held in Italy without trial for 16 years. In the course of that period, and indeed probably quite early on, he adopted a very Roman perspective on the world, something that was very unusual in the case of the Greeks. In the words of Elizabeth Rawson, he became quite possibly, I quote, the first Greek public man to be really trusted in Rome. And after he was released in 150 BC, he seems to have made it his business to improve relations between the two peoples. The monument that was erected to him in his hometown of Megalopolis stated that he had, I quote, roamed over the entire earth and sea and had been the ally of the Romans and had quenched their anger against the Greeks. That's an interesting statement. It suggests that Polybius played a crucial role as a mediator, softening the Roman attitude towards the Greeks. There were some Romans, however, Cato the Elder being the prime example, who did all they could to keep Greeks out of Rome. In 173 BC, for instance, the Roman Senate expelled two Epicurean philosophers, partly, no doubt, because it was suspicious, as we have seen, of their scorn for traditional religious observance. Then again in 161, the Senate passed a decree indiscriminately expelling all philosophers and rhetoricians from Rome. Within 6 years, however, a significant change in attitude had occurred. In 155 BC, three Greek philosophers representing the three major schools visited Rome in an official delegation, and they addressed the Senate through an interpreter. Diogenes, head of the Stoic school, Critolaus, head of the Peripatetic or Aristotelian school, and Carneades, head of the Academy established by Plato. Each of the three also gave well-attended public lectures. Carneades seems to have drawn the largest crowds by arguing on two sides of the same question. Firstly, for the importance of justice in international relations, and then the next day for the very opposite. How very Greek. In the end, of course, Cato could do nothing either to check the Roman appetite for all things Greek or to prevent the entry of Greeks into the intellectual milieu. In the following century, too, there were lots of highly educated Greeks who took up residence in Rome. One was Philo, head of the Academy in Athens, who came to Rome probably to escape the upheavals caused by the Mithridatic Wars in the 80s BC. Cicero, who attended his lectures, describes being utterly blown away by him. Another was Apollonius Molon, an orator from Rhodes, who was the first ambassador to address the Senate in Greek. There was also a considerable number of Greek diplomats whiling away their time in the capital in the 1st century BC. Polybius and Scipio apart, we know very little about the quality of personal interactions between Romans and Greeks, though few of them are likely to have become best buddies. I suspect that even top-rank intellectuals would have been treated with a certain degree of condescension by their Roman overlords. It's interesting, too, that Cicero, who was by far the most prolific correspondent of ancient times and deeply imbued with Hellenic culture, hardly penned a single letter to a Greek. So far as we know, he didn't have any Greeks among his friends, unless we include his slave Tyro, to whom he dictated his correspondence. It was also the case that anyone with talent or ambition eventually ended up in Rome. This was true of the missionary Paul, albeit under some form of house arrest, the philosopher and historian Plutarch, and the superstar of late antiquity in medicine, Galen, as well as many, many others. Galen's career, in fact, exemplifies that of any ambitious and talented Greek. Having honed his craft in a number of cities, Pergamum, Smyrna, Corinth, and Alexandria, he arrived in Rome at the age of about 30. 4 years later, he fled back to Pergamum. Like many dynamic individuals, he'd made too many powerful enemies. But he was back in Rome a couple of years afterwards, this time at the request of the Emperor Marcus Aurelius himself, and he stayed in Rome until his death. Rome, in fact, remained the centre to which those with talent and ambition gravitated, not just educated individuals, but also mimes, pantomimes, musicians, singers, dancers, charioteers, and even gladiators. And it remained a magnet until Constantinople became the centre of the imperial court from the 330s onwards and increasingly formed a counterweight to Rome. Up till now, I've been talking primarily about a very small and, for the most part, highly mobile group of Greeks living in Rome. Next, I want to talk about the literally thousands upon thousands of Greeks who came to Rome as slaves. It was undoubtedly through the institution of slavery that the two peoples came most regularly into contact with one another on a daily basis. A number of slaves, like Livius Andronicus, entered Rome in the aftermath to the wars with Pyrrhus, which ended in 272 BC. The first really big influx, however, occurred after the Battle of Pydna in 168 BC. A second wave occurred in the 80s, following the end of the Mithridatic Wars. Most well-to-do households would have aspired to own a Greek slave as a kind of status symbol, just as English butlers are sometimes in demand in the homes of super-rich Americans. But that does not mean that the two sides entered into a trusting relationship with one another. Far from it, I suspect, though it did give them the chance to observe one another at close quarters. Many of these Greeks eventually became freedmen and found themselves in competition with Romans, not least in their capacity as clients of their former masters. And that's the situation we encountered in a previous lecture, which had to do with racial stereotyping. You may recall that I quoted Umbricius, a character in one of Juvenal's satires, saying, I quote, "I can't abide a Greek Rome, my fellow countrymen." Juvenal's dates are circa 55 to 130 AD, but the phenomenon that Umbricius is describing has its roots a century or more earlier. I want to hold out to you a tantalizing observation by Ramsay MacMullan, a scholar who has done pioneering work in the area of Greco-Roman culture. In Cicero's day, MacMullan writes, that's to say around the middle of the first century BC, the largest Greek city in the world, or at least the one that tied with Alexandria in Egypt for that honor, if by Greek, he says, we may mean inhabited by people whose parents spoke Greek as their first language, was, wait for it, Rome. Alexandria, the city founded by Alexander the Great, had a population at this date of about 250,000. So we can imagine how many Greeks there were in Rome. So much, then, for Greeks living in Rome. Next, I want to turn to the subject of Romans living in Greece. From the point of view of the elite, I'm going to be talking about three phenomena: Romans studying in Greece, Romans touring in Greece, and Romans residing in Greece. Cato the Elder is quoted as writing to his son the following: "I shall speak in the proper place of those damned Greeks. I will show you the results of my own experience at Athens, namely that it's okay to dip into their literature, but not to imbibe it thoroughly. I shall prove how detestable and worthless is their race. Believe me, Marcus, my son, this is an oracular saying. If ever that race comes to pass its literature onto us, all is lost." Note that Cato let slip the fact that he himself resided in Athens, and he probably did so as a student. If so, he was leading the charge. We don't hear of any other Romans studying in Greece for some time. But by the beginning of the early decades of the first century BC, it had become fashionable for young Romans to complete their education there, notably in Athens or on the island of Rhodes. Cicero, for one, tells us that he spent 6 months studying in Athens before, I quote, "traveling through all of Asia, where I studied with all the most distinguished orators, and I then went on to Rhodes, returning to Rome after 2 years' absence." Two years, note. Cicero's contemporary, Julius Caesar, was on his way to study in Rhodes before being captured by pirates. And in August 44 BC, 5 months after his assassination, Marcus Brutus, one of the assassins, decided that it was becoming too dangerous to stay in Rome. So he decided to call in at Athens before going off to Crete, which the Senate had assigned him as his province. Athens was a natural choice. With its still active philosophical schools, it was a lively place of philosophical inquiry. And more than that, the Athenians could be expected to sympathize with a tyrannicide, since they too, many centuries earlier, had had their run-in with tyrants, which is how Brutus regarded Caesar. In fact, when Brutus arrived, the Athenians feted him. They even erected a statue to him and his co-conspirator, Caius Cassius, in the Agora, at the same place, approximately, where a statue of the two tyrannicides of Athens, Harmodius and Aristogiton, had been erected. Well, this tells us a lot about relations between the Greeks and the Romans in the late Republic. We see that there were close intellectual ties between educated Romans and Greeks who shared particularly a similar worldview. And secondly, that Athens was a natural place for Roman intellectuals to gravitate towards. Here, if anywhere, on Greek soil, surrounded by the imperishable monuments to Athens' glorious classical past, personal ties among the elite may have overridden the basic asymmetry in the relationship between the two peoples. Brutus wasn't the only famous Roman who was spending time in Athens in 44 BC. The young poet Horace was also there, no doubt deriving inspiration from the Greek-style symposium that features so prominently as a setting for much of his poetry. And so too was Cicero's son, studying philosophy. Incidentally, when the young Octavian learned of Caesar's assassination, he also happened to be studying philosophy in Greece at a place called Apollonia on the west coast opposite Brindisi. The next phenomenon I want to look at is tourism. You'll recall that in 168 BC, the Romans defeated Perseus at the Battle of Pydna, thereby ending the Third Macedonian War. The victorious general was Lucius Aemilius Paulus, an out-and-out Philhellene. It says much about his priorities that the only spoils that he confiscated from the war were the contents of Perseus's library. It was very unusual for a Roman to show such restraint. Anyway, when the war was over, Paulus decided to do the sights of Greece. He may have been the first Roman ever to become a tourist in Greece. The Roman historian Livy provides us with his itinerary. First, he hit, I quote, the famous oracular shrine at Delphi. He then went on to gawp at the shrine of the oracular hero Trophonius at Levadia in central Greece. From there, he went to Chalcis on the island of Euboea to check out a natural wonder, the tidal flow at the Euripus Strait, which changes direction several times a day. Then he moseyed on to the harbour at Aulis, close to Chalcis, from which the Greek chieftain Agamemnon launched his fleet of 1,000 ships to recover Helen, thus beginning the Trojan War. Then our tourist took in Oropus in Attica, where an ancient prophet is worshipped as if he were a god, in Livy's phrase. Paulus seems to have been particularly keen on oracular shrines. And from there, he went on to Athens, no doubt the high point of his trip, where he took in the Acropolis, the walls that linked Athens to its port, some 5 miles in length, its famous shipsheds in the Piraeus, and so on. And then to Corinth, which, of course, the Romans destroyed 20 years later. Next, to various cities in the Peloponnese, including Sicyon, Argos, Sparta, and Megalopolis, his final stop being Olympia, home of the Olympic Games, and of the great sanctuary of Olympian Zeus. Paulus was your ideal tourist, indefatigable, curious, and diplomatic. He never once asked any of the Greeks he encountered how they felt about the Roman victory over Macedon as, a quote from Livy, he didn't want to trouble them with fear. What a star he was. Well, Paulus's jaw may well have dropped several times as he gazed up at the monuments, but this didn't stop him from sacking Epirus the following year. In other words, he didn't let his love of Greece prevent him from carrying out his Roman duty. Political Philhellenism, as I called it in an earlier lecture, seems to have had few adherents in the 160s BC. Incidentally, Paulus did the tour with his biological son, Scipio Aemilianus, a friend of Polybius, who had been adopted into the Scipio family. Greece seems to have left a very deep impression on the young Scipio. It seems to have been under the impress of this visit that when he got back to Rome, he began to associate with Greek intellectuals, Polybius among them. Until the imperial period, the number of Romans who visited Greece would have been pretty low. When Cicero had to stay in the Piraeus, the port town of Athens, in 45 BC, he couldn't find an inn for love or money. The tourist industry had yet to take off. Most Romans probably stayed with the local bigwigs. Tourism seems to have really got going in Greece in the first century AD. The fact that emperors from Augustus onwards spent time in Greece meant not only that Greece attracted the eye of imperial patronage, but also that those in their entourage got a taste of the old country. And it now became fashionable for wealthy Romans to go on sightseeing tours of Greece, rather in the same way that wealthy Europeans went on a grand tour in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And it wasn't just the Romans who went in for sightseeing of this kind. Greeks from all over the Greek-speaking world visited Greece to explore their roots, much as contemporary Americans might go to Europe or Asia today for the same reason. This new trend is reflected in the work of a Greek called Pausanias, who was writing in the late 50s to late 70s of the 2nd century AD. Pausanias wrote a guide to Greece in 10 books. He claimed to be describing all things Greek, but in fact, he's quite selective in what he chooses to write about. And that in turn tells us a lot about the interests of tourists of his day. He's particularly interested in places that played a major role in Greek history in some way, such as Athens and Sparta, and major sanctuaries like Delphi and Olympia. His omissions, however, are very revealing in terms of the taste of the age. In particular, he has little to say about the Parthenon, the number one tourist stop today. The famous frieze, now regarded as one of the glories of classical Greek art, doesn't receive a mention, and he says pretty little about the architecture. What interested him is the statue of Athena, cased in gold and ivory, which it housed. He's especially drawn to monuments that had been around for a long time, particularly those of the archaic and classical ages. He gives very little attention to things that post-date 150 BC, the period, that is, since Greece became a Roman province, although he does note the generous benefactions of the Emperor Hadrian. So he's treating the sites of Greece as a relic of a bygone era, which is probably how most Romans regarded it too. Pausanias wasn't the first to write in this kind of vein. Strabo, who lived in the reign of Augustus, had already written a work called The Geography, which, though broader in compass, demonstrated a somewhat similar interest. And long before Strabo, a certain Heraclides, Criticus, living in the 3rd century BC, had written a work called The Cities of Greece, of which only fragments remain. Sensing that there was money to be made from exploiting the Roman fascination with old Greece, the Greeks took steps to further pique their interest. In particular, they expanded the number of their games and offered expensive prizes to victors in order to attract the maximum numbers of visitors from abroad. To supplement the 4 ancient Panhellenic games, other games were introduced, including the Asclepian games at Epidaurus, the Olympia Comedia at Sparta, and the Panhellenia, Olympia, and Hadriania at Athens. As the names Comedia and Hadriania indicate, these were games held in honour of the emperors Commodus and Hadrian, respectively, and we may suspect that they were intended to have a particular appeal for Roman tourists. Drama, notably in the form of revivals of classical tragedy, also continued to flourish, both on the mainland and in the Greek East. And in the previous lecture, I mentioned the cult of Artemis Orthia at Sparta, for instance, which clearly underwent a revival at this time. Thirdly, I want to talk about Romans residing in Greece. It is a fact that there were a few Romans who became so besotted with Greek culture that they actually took up residence in Greece. One of the very first to do so is a praetor, a magistrate by the name of Titus Albucius. When Albucius was residing in Athens in 119 BC, a military commander named Quintus Mucius Scaevola, who was passing through on his way to Asia, ordered his soldiers to address Albucius in Greek, or probably in a kind of comic Greek. He was showing contempt for the fact that Albucius had adopted Greek ways. Anyway, once back in Rome, Albucius was condemned for extortion, so he decided to leave the city for good and spend his retirement abroad. And not surprisingly, he retired to Athens, where he devoted himself to the study of Epicurean philosophy. Incidentally, Scaevola was a total hypocrite. He'd actually studied under a Stoic philosopher called Panaetius, who belonged to Scipio's circle in Rome, and he was no doubt just as conversant with Greek culture as Albucius. Probably the most famous Roman refugee of all, I'm using the term metaphorically, was Cicero's friend and co-correspondent, Titus Pomponius Atticus. Atticus was a member of the equestrian order, a knight that is, with no interest in politics. So in 85 BC, he took the bold step of selling all his property in Italy and moving permanently to Athens. Hence the surname or cognomen Atticus, meaning of Attica, the territory surrounding Athens. Dear old Atticus wanted to get away from it all. He wanted to live a life of otium, the word for leisure you'll recall. Specifically, he wanted to get away from the civil war involving Sulla that he rightly saw coming. And once in Athens, he devoted himself to two things. Number one, Epicurean philosophy, and two, making money. He did rather well at making money, but was not so successful at the former, or at least, if he was, no original philosophical work is extant from him. Probably throughout history, the vast majority of the Romans who stepped onto Greek soil did so wearing military boots. The Romans first crossed to the Greek mainland to engage in military expeditions in the Illyrian and Macedonian Wars, but they also fought a number of battles in their civil wars in Greece. Caesar defeated Pompey at Pharsalus, Antony and Octavian defeated Caesar's assassins at Philippi, and Octavian defeated Mark Antony at Actium. We don't know how many soldiers were stationed in Greece at any one time, though in general, the Romans ran their empire with a skeletal force in the pacified provinces. As an occupying power, however, it's likely that their relationship with the host population was strained at best. The only permanent group of Romans who were resident in Greece in large numbers were the army veterans and freedmen. They were given land that had been seized from the local population, as we saw in the previous lecture in the case of Corinth. It was hardly a recipe for easy relations. We've investigated a lot of reasons why Greeks would go to Rome and why Romans would go to Greece, but we're still left with some basic questions, and it's these that I want to turn to last. They're so basic it's almost embarrassing to ask them. First, did Greeks and Romans live next door to one another? There's no evidence either way, but I very much doubt it. Foreigners in big cities like Rome and Alexandria tended to live in ghettos, as we would call them today. Coexistence, not cohabitation, probably defined their relationship. Second, what was the incidence of mixed marriages between Romans and Greeks? Well, the fact is, we hardly hear of any. One Greek who did marry a Roman, however, was Herodes Atticus, a very wealthy Athenian philanthropist of the 2nd century AD, whom I'll be talking about in a later lecture. Herodes married an aristocratic woman named Regilla. He was also probably the first Greek to be elected to the Roman Senate, and quite possibly the two facts are not unrelated. We know as well that he was fabulously wealthy. There's little evidence about mixed marriages lower down the social scale, although it's worth noting that Roman soldiers were forbidden to marry. Human nature being what it is, however, unofficial marriages took place instead. We even have evidence from Egypt supporting this suggestion. By the 2nd century AD, the policy, however, was more honoured in the breach than in the observance, and in AD 197, Septimius Severus lifted the ban altogether. To conclude, we've examined a variety of ways in which members of the Greek and Roman elite came to experience one another's culture firsthand. We've also seen how Greeks, in their capacity as slaves, and Romans, in their capacity as soldiers and veterans, coexisted somewhat uneasily in one another's company. In the next lecture, we're going to look at the ways in which the Emperor Augustus was profoundly influenced by Greek culture, and we may suspect, quite directly, by Greeks living in Rome.